So I was reflecting on freedom, and sort of lots of images come to my mind. So there's images from our popular culture. This is kind of a strange one, but it came up for me. The Old Spice advert with the surfer on the waves, probably on a Hawaii beach or something like that, with the Carmina Burana playing in the background. I won't continue the playing in the background, and just that freedom of surfing and just being away from everything. And there's songs of freedom, like the songs of John Lennon and Imagine, for example, and the songs by Bob Marley in particular. And also images for me of freedom fighters, actually. That really came up strongly for me, strange enough. So there's Che Guevara, the beret-wearing doctor who became a revolutionary after travelling around South America and seeing the suffering. And I've got a quote from him, which I really love, actually. And it's just simply, the true revolutionary is guided by love. I really love that, yeah. And there's Nelson Mandela that came into my mind. Yeah, so he's imprisoned for over 25 years, fighting against apartheid. And again, another quote of his I love. For to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. And also another inspiration for me, another sort of image of freedom, is Muhammad Ali, actually, the boxer. And again, he was imprisoned as well, and he lost his world title because he refused to fight in the Vietnam War. You know, he didn't believe in it. But also, he actually took a strong opposition to the racism that was prevalent in the US at the time. And again, I've got a little quote of his, which I quite like as well. So, Cassius Clay is a slave name. I didn't choose it, and I don't want it. I am Muhammad Ali, a free name. It means beloved of God, and I insist people use it when people speak to me and of me. And you can kind of imagine him sort of saying that, can't you? Sort of very powerful. But of course, there's images from the Buddhist tradition, and we are here at Bamaloka. As Harsha Prabhu says, I could go on for hours on different aspects, but I'll try and keep it focused to Buddhism today. And I thought I'd draw firstly from the Buddha's life, actually. And then I'll be talking a little bit about Bhante, and then myself, to indulge slightly. So in the course of the Buddha's life, there's of course lots of freedom, aspects of freedom in it. And firstly, of course, there's Siddhartha, as he was before he became the Buddha. Siddhartha's going forth, and that image of him leaving his palaces, his wife, perhaps, if he had one, difficult to know, his child, if he did, certainly his wealth, his social position, riding on the horse with Chandana, and just riding out, and and just leaving those palaces in Kapilavastu, and going forth. And there's many images and many stories of that going forth. But actually one of the oldest texts, which is when the Buddha reminisces in his old age to his disciples, that I'm going to quote from. And he simply says, "Then I, monks, after a time, being young, my hair coal black, possessed of radiant youth, in the prime of my life, although my unwilling parents wept and wailed, having cut off my hair and beard, having put on the yellow robes, went forth from home into homelessness." So it can't have been easy for Siddhartha to leave his family, but it also represents his freedom from the group, and it's personified, you know, by that action of going forth. So it's a freedom over his cultural and family conditioning, and it's sort of taking the initiative for himself. It meant living his own life, and it meant him becoming an individual. So Bhante obviously has a lot to say about what a true individual is. So the next event I'm just going to mention, it's when the Buddha, after having gone forth into homelessness, he approached on separate occasions two spiritual teachers, the most famous spiritual teachers of the time in India. And each of them taught the Buddha, or Siddhartha as he was then, all and everything they knew. And each time Siddhartha excelled and he reached the pinnacle of their teaching. And each time the teacher either offered them leadership of the group or shared leadership, and each time Siddhartha refused because he realised that wasn't what he wanted, that wasn't truly what he was seeking. So this was a freedom by him taking that refusal, and it was a freedom over spiritual complacency and also spiritual ambition. He knew there was more to discover, and he wasn't concerned with leadership. He was concerned with the search for truth. And it's just interesting, by the by, to mention that he overcame spiritual complacency and spiritual ambition, if you like, well, not quite simultaneously, as they're quite connected. If we're spiritually ambitious, in the sense that we're seeking spiritual leadership, we're likely to become, or we could become, spiritually complacent. Similarly, if we're going to become spiritually complacent, we may then tend to find that we search for spiritual leadership roles, as it were, to compensate that. So it's something to be aware of as we get more involved, I suppose. So the next freedom depicted in the Buddha's life that's inspiring to me anyway is his freedom over fear. So this is represented by him going forth into the forests and meditating there with, and the forests in India, of course, not like the forests here in the in England, yeah. So the forests in India were a scary place, and not only were they physically scary with snakes and tigers, there were also bandits, and also there was a lot of mystery and myth around at the time, you know, about being haunted and ghosts and so forth. So there was all that as well to overcome. Yet Siddhartha went and he practiced in solitary places in the forest, and overcoming his fear. I mean, and it's a fear too that I think we will need to overcome in our own search for freedom. But of course, we won't probably, presumably, be going off into the forests of India. But nevertheless, there's that internal fear that we must overcome. So the next freedom, or example of freedom, that Siddhartha, I suppose, goes through, experiences, is when he's practicing his extreme asceticism. So he went through a stage of becoming the most famous ascetic in Northeast India at the time, and through starving himself, so much so that he could sort of touch his backbone, it said, through his stomach. So by pressing, he would actually touch the back of his spine. So he was extremely thin, presumably, yeah. And he realised, he came to the realisation that this wasn't the way for him to win his ultimate freedom. And so he was prepared to start again. He was prepared to admit his mistakes. So even though his spiritual companions with him at the time, they left him as well in disgust, he knew that he had to give it all up, as it were, and start again, if you like. So this represents the freedom over that human tendency to refuse to admit that we've made a mistake, that we've wasted time and energy, and that we need to start again. And then there's obviously the episode, probably the most famous episode, of course, of freedom, in Siddhartha's finally going to sit under that Bodhi tree in Northeast India, to sit under that in this month in May. Although we've missed the full moon, but the full moon in May, to sit down and gain full and perfect enlightenment. And of course, that's the complete destruction of greed, hatred and delusion, and him winning final, well, not final, winning nirvana, like full and perfect enlightenment, complete freedom. So there's obviously that example of freedom in the Buddha's life. And even so, there's one more example that I'm going to draw on. Even after achieving full and perfect enlightenment, there's still another freedom in the Buddha's life that we can draw on, that we can take inspiration from, and that's his freedom over spiritual individualism, by taking up the path of teaching and going out to others, because he was still not satisfied with his accomplishments. So he could have perhaps taken it easy, but he He chose to go out and teach, and he did so until he died. Yeah. So these images of freedom from the Buddha's own life, I hope, are of inspiration to you, and you can draw on them as they are for me. And very much in our movement at the moment, there's a real tendency, you know, imagining the Buddha, bringing the Buddha more alive to us. So by considering these aspects of stories in terms of freedom, it's another way of looking, appreciating and getting to know the Buddha, I think. So there's images of freedom from our own teacher, Sangharakshita, which also come up for me when I reflected on freedom. There's the image, the most famous image, I think, of him tearing up his passport while he lived in India and becoming a monk. And of course, deciding to set up a new Buddhist movement in spite of the opposition. So one of my favourite books by Bhante is not his Dharma texts, his writings. It's actually his autobiography, The Rainbow Road. And I've just got a short passage from The Rainbow Road when he realises and sets out and goes out into this path, yeah, of homelessness. So he says, "There was only one way out. Religious societies, organisations and groups, far from being a help to spiritual development, were only a hindrance. However lofty the ideals with which they were founded, they had a natural tendency to degenerate in the hands of selfish human beings into instruments for the acquisition of money, position, power and fame. Instead of trying any longer to work with them, we would follow the example of the Buddha and sever at one stroke our connection with an incorrigible world. We would renounce the household life and go forth into the life of homelessness as wanderers in search of truth. For the last few months we had only sat hesitantly on the shore of the vast ocean in the spiritual life. Now, casting aside all fear, we would plunge boldly in." And then that chapter finishes as he walks away with his friend, and why the book's called The Rainbow Road, of course. "So as we left Kasali, it was raining, but as in the course of our descent we emerged from the clouds into the bright sunshine below, we saw arching the road at intervals of a few dozen yards, not only single but double and triple rainbows. Each time we turned a bend, we found more rainbows waiting for us. We passed through them as though through the multicoloured arcades of some celestial palace." I love that image of him walking off into the sunset, as it were, a bit like a western in a way. I don't think he'd appreciate me saying that. And of course there's some images of freedom in my own life, but I'm going to draw on those a bit later on. So I'm going to say a little bit more about freedom now generally, yeah. So the image or the ideal of freedom really inspires me, actually. And I realised actually when I was reflecting more and more that this is actually what I am seeking on a really deep level, yeah. The stories, songs and people who represent that for me, I hold above all others. So there's the Buddha, there's Bhante, these ideas, these freedom fighters. And so, you know, to give a talk on freedom, really, it's thrilling for me, it's exciting. But I wonder if I can really do it justice. There's so much, actually, there's so much. Sort of, you kind of, when you're giving a talk, you kind of live that life, and every reference, you sort of crop up freedom, freedom, freedom. It's sort of everywhere. And, you know, so much more could go in, but limited time, of course. So theoretically, we're in control of our own lives and we can make our own decisions. We can vote for the government of our own choice. We can choose what products to buy, what job to take. We can choose whether or not to get married, have children, who we hang out with. What religion we can practice and so on. You know, in this country, we're pretty free, yeah. But we don't really feel free. So why is that, yeah? In this country of freedom of speech, and you know, we've got food available close to our roof overhead. So why is that, yeah? So when we talk about freedom, we're talking about its opposite. So there's bondage, lack of control, lack of independence. And we don't like this, one bit in fact. We can feel quite angry or distressed when we feel our rights or life and liberty are taken away from us, when we are not given the control and the choices that we want. I mean, I feel quite angry about the merest thought of my time being taken from me against my will, and feel upset when I hear the injustices of the world. You know, when Tibetans can't practice the Buddha Dharma, people looked up against the unfair regimes in the world, where 80% of the world live in poverty, you know, living on less than $10 a day. I mean, the nature of samsara is clearly unsatisfactory, but even so, it does make me mad. But according to the Buddha, we all have the capability to be free. So the true nature of our mind is pure, aware, full of wisdom and compassion. It's open, it's clear, it's bright. We don't, obviously, on a day-to-day level at least, perceive this. And we live in a state of delusion and often self-imposed suffering, in fact. So the Buddhist path can offer us a way to free ourselves from the illusions that we create for ourselves, and also those of our society, and those that our religious and cultural impositions create too. And it's not easy to see beyond our conditioning to break through the expectations of our family, of society, our religious groups, and see the nature of our own mind. In fact, it can be difficult to realise how far our own conditioning actually does affect us, how much our parents' influences affect us, and those of our friends as well. And even the language that we use has a profound effect on how we see the world. This is my turn to be a bit self-indulgent now. So my own experience of this was when I travelled to Israel after graduating from university. So my parents wanted me to start a proper career, and they helped me to get a job in our family business, and they bought me a flat in Croydon, and that's where I was brought up. I bought a little car for £150, very cheap, and I even bought my first business suit. However, after graduating, I went on a two-week vacation to Greece to celebrate my graduation, in effect. And when I was there, I realised I didn't want this. I didn't want this kind of life. I didn't want to settle down. I didn't want a job. I didn't want to work till I was 65, retire, and then die. That wasn't the life for me. And my spirit felt free when I was in Greece. I was running around a bit like a lunatic, actually, if truth be known. And I just wanted to be free of all the expectations placed on me. And really, that was my first real taste of freedom, yeah. So I was young and happy and enjoying life to the full. And I was on this beautiful island of Paros in Greece. And I was free. I was really free. I felt free. And so I decided that I was not going to go back to England. I was going to stay in Greece. And I started chatting to a Scottish chap who worked at a cafe, and he said he needed to get home. He had no way financially of getting home, and he was planning to cycle home. And I said, well, we worked out it would take him about a month to get home, and he didn't have any money. So I sold him my return ticket. I think it was for £10, and I took his job on at the cafe. And I phoned up my mum and dad and said, I've given my return ticket away. I'm not coming home. And they went absolutely ballistic at me and said, you must come home. You know, we need to talk about this. Anyway, I think that was my moment of truth. And I said no to my parents. And they cut off ties for me. And it didn't feel, you know, good to fall out with them. I knew I kind of had to do that. And I'd really been brought up under my parents, really, and their expectations. And my mum and dad, and I've been brought up in a, you know, Jewish life. Jewish parents, believe me, have a lot of expectations, yeah. But the main thing I remember from the conversation, ironically, is when I phoned up my mum from Greece, and I said, you know, I'm not coming. I will remember my Jewish mother, I hope she doesn't listen to this talk, actually, but it's the cry of my Jewish mother saying, but what about the suit? Sorry, Mum, just in case. I realised I was, to an extent, on my own then. So I had to save money while I was working in that cafe, and I decided to go across to Israel by boat. And eventually I got to Israel. I just managed to get in with some difficulty, actually. That's another story. And I ended up on a kibbutz. And I ended up staying there for quite some years, actually. And in the meantime, of course, I made up with my parents. But actually, during that time, I really did start a journey of self-discovery. I was often very alone there. I didn't speak the language. I was learning the language. And I didn't really have anything to particularly fall back on. But in a way, strangely enough, you know, with all that, everything became a lot clearer for me. And I started seeing how life is more and more. Learning a new language, communicating in it. I was thinking differently and living in a completely different culture. But in a way, I felt like a new being. Yeah, I was like coming on. And that police song kept on coming into my head kind of thing. And it still does. You know, that song, I'm an alien, I'm a legal alien. Although, it's a bit of a take, I'm an Englishman in Israel. I won't sing that. So I learned a lot about myself at this time, and I changed an awful lot. So when I left England, I was a bit of a wild child, truth be known, and I loved to party, and I had a pretty easy life, really. But I was pretty superficial, let's be honest, I was. But when I came back to England, I was kind of like this new being. I became a vegetarian, I gave up smoking. I gave up drinking as well. I got into yoga. I started meditating. I mean, and I found out a lot from books and so forth. And occasionally I met these friends on the way, and they showed me another way of being, really. And there were some, you know, days and nights, you know, the dark nights of the soul. There were some tough times there. But by distancing myself from all that cultural and parental obligation, I kind of found a new me, a real me. One that was a lot freer and more myself, or how I wanted to be. But my search for freedom actually wasn't yet over, I have to say. It's still not over. So after spending some years to Israel, I decided to become a full Israeli citizen. By virtue of my Jewish heritage, you can take your right to return, yeah? And I decided I wanted to do this. I wanted to live in Israel, become an Israeli citizen. And this is a long process. And part of that process involves becoming part of the Israeli war machine. You have to join the army, basically. That's part of obligation for all people there. And I had to go to the army headquarters and undertake various psychological, mental, physical tests and so forth. But at some point during this process, I started having second thoughts, yeah? I started realising, not quite like the Buddha, but realising I'd made a mistake, actually, and I didn't want to live in Israel. And I started seeing for all of it and started not liking what was going on. And, I started to find myself not agreeing with the war and what was going on in Israel. And actually, one of the times I went to the army headquarters, I remember looking in the back of the bathroom door and somebody had inscribed the words of the door song, The End. This is the end, my only friend, the end. And I just started panicking and thinking, I'm going to get shot in Lebanon. I had all these visions that I wasn't going to come back. If I end up, I'm not going to get back to England. I'm not going to get home. Yeah, I mean, there are reasons for that. I mean, I'm, take off my glasses, I am severely blind. I can't see anybody, actually. It's just all a big blur. And I've got no sense of direction whatsoever. I mean, I've been lost in Sirlingham, for God's sakes. So it was quite a reasonable vision to have, that I would get shot and killed and, yeah, be taken back in a box of some kind. So I thought, right, I don't want to do the army. Problem. UK passport was with the Israeli authorities. They don't return your passport. You have to go through the process. And there's only two ways to get out of the Israeli army. One is to become fully religious, obviously in the Jewish tradition. I could have probably got away with the Buddhist, but you couldn't have done that. So I'd have had to become what's known as a frum Jew, donned the old black hat and the beard. Yeah. So I could have been standing here, you never know, with a big beard on. Or you go mad. So I took the second route to obtain my freedom. It was a bit of a risky approach, but when I undertook one of my psychological profiles, there's a sort of section right at the end, once you've answered all these questions, which actually I can fly through all these questions, but at the bottom it says, is there anything else you want to say? This is all in Hebrew, by the way. And I said, yes, I have smoked marijuana. Or I think I smoked marijuana. And handed in the paper and then went back to the kibbutz. And of course I got a letter from Army Headquarters hauling me back into the HQ about this. And it was a gamble, because actually in Israel, well, like here, it's illegal to smoke, Dave. And actually it's imprisonable for 7 years, up to 7 years you can get in prison for. So it was a bit of a gamble. So I went back to the Army Headquarters, and I was sat facing three Army officials. And I think one was an Army psychiatrist, and they were just barraging me with questions. I can't remember many of them. And one I remember was, why do you feel the need to take something external to yourself for happiness? Which was an interesting question when I look back now. I had my kind of get out. My plan was, and say, well, I have smoked, but I don't anymore. So this was my idea at the time in my deluded state. But it was sufficient. And actually, there was a point in that interview, one of the guys said to me, he said, do you want to go into the army? Do you want to join the Israeli army? And it hit me as a bit of a shock that it was kind of like I had that choice. And actually, strange enough, when I was thinking about this, I thought I had that same experience in the Kuti at Vajrasana, just before my ordination, and Arta Priya sat opposite me. He says, are you ready for ordination? Do you want to be ordained? And it kind of hit me again. I've got this choice. Incidentally, I did say no to the Israeli army and yes to ordination, but that same kind of, it hit me. I have a choice, and it's up to me. So, yeah. So, and on that basis, it just started a whole rolling program. You know, they returned my passport. Okay, we'll give you release from the army. Get me my passport back. And I booked up that return flight and I got back as quick as I could, actually. And it was soon after coming back to the UK, I came across the what was then the FWBO, but of course now the Tree Ratna. And they like crazy people, so I felt at home. That was in 1997, 15 years ago that was. I met your Yehoshua, yeah. Came along 15 years ago, yeah. Now, when I left England originally, you know, when I went off to Israel, I knew what I didn't want. I didn't want that life. I didn't want Sam in life. It kind of felt to me like a whole kind of death, actually, of a waste of a life, actually. But also, I didn't really know what I did want. I didn't know. I knew there was something more, but I didn't really know what it was. I knew I didn't want that, but I knew I wanted something else, yeah? So in order to find freedom, we need to look for it. It's not going to come. I mean, obviously, practicing now, we realise it's not going to come from outside us. Not only do we need to look for it, we do need to want it. And we need to really want freedom, I think. Unless we realise we're in prison, this is a bit of a metaphor, Sanganista will like this, he likes this. We won't look for release. And this is the problem. We don't necessarily realise we're in prison, or samsara, if you like. We kind of like to make everything nice and comfortable here in samsara. So we fit out our cell with a nice flat screen TV, perhaps. Perhaps we get a little Apple Mac. Perhaps we get a nice rug for our little cell. And we find some nice coffee and we drink our nice coffee. But actually, if we start looking around, we might sort of catch a glimpse of a steel bar, maybe a locked door somewhere, limitations on where we can go. So when we're talking about freedom, we should ask, freedom from what? Do we think it means freedom from external control, to do whatever we please? So this might feel temporary liberating, but could it actually bring pain? Or would we like choice, sort of unlimited choice perhaps? Would this really bring happiness? I remember coming off a retreat one time, as perhaps you may experience this, and hitting Tesco's on the way back to Colchester and being completely overwhelmed by all the products, yeah? Absolutely, it's been so easy on retreat. This is our lunch, I don't know what it is, probably soup, curry Friday night at this time. Everything's all set out and it's quite liberating. But I just went into this superstore and there's just stuff everywhere. So much stuff, so much choice. And I thought, you know, I couldn't even find, you know, what type of bread to buy. There were so many. And actually, this is a strange bit of research, but I went on Tesco.com for this talk just to research how many types of bread there were out of interest. Would you believe there were 536 options of bread? Yet, when I go to buy bread, I pretty much buy the same loaf every time. Yeah, and I think it's a bit like that with our lives. We just go through the same routines, yeah? So just because we have the choice, it doesn't mean we achieve freedom. And paradoxically, if we want to embrace freedom, we have to shut down on our choices. So, for example, if you want children, you've got to give up your Sunday lines, for example, yeah? We act from habitual patterns, either consciously or unconsciously, and we live our lives like this. Our mind is what locks us in, and therefore it's the source of our suffering. And so it's the mind that can ultimately release us. And the better we know our mind, the greater the possibility of liberation. So when we sit and meditate, and perhaps we writhe around, perhaps we become agitated, we get lost in an array of thoughts, I kind of figure to myself, that's okay, because at least I'm learning what my mind's like. And our mind can be like someone we pass on the street every day. So we see them, but we don't really stop to talk to them. We don't even know them intimately sometimes. We may notice they're a little bit changeable, and maybe they've got likes and dislikes, and sometimes they get angry and sometimes upset, sometimes our friend, sometimes our worst enemy. But not knowing our mind means we cannot fully appreciate who we really are, and we cannot fully experience our lives. We are, in fact, in a prison of sorts, and we don't recognise our own natural potential for fulfilment. But when we see the true nature of our mind, we are relieved of the deep anxiety of life, and we don't need to spend time labelling. We are aware of our feelings, and there's more open experience of being, and this brings energy, and we do need to free up energy to practice. And we should be aware that it is an individual freedom that we seek. It's an individual path, actually. We don't all suffer in the same way. So what my drives are not necessarily your drives. What my senses move towards is not what your senses necessarily move towards. Our tastes and inclinations are not the same. However, we are all inclined towards pleasure and away from pain. And that's something we can all resonate with. We're drawn to what we like and away from what we do not like. And the more integrated we are, the more we can go beyond this inclination and act from a more accepting perspective. So integration, which is kind of what I'm leading to here, is seen as the first of the five great stages of the spiritual life. And obviously the others are, just for your reference, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, and if you like, altruistic activity. And these stages are often related to different practices. So of course, in the cases of integration, it's a mindfulness of breathing practice. And positive emotion would be the metta bhavana and so on. Yeah. So the more we practice the mindfulness, the more we hone in on our breath, the more our mind calms and it settles. So it kind of just brings us more into being an integrated full being. So I'm going to try and reference that more now to the sutta that we're going to be studying in our study groups. So we're going to be looking at the simile of the six animals. Yeah. And I'm just going to sort of draw on that a little bit now just to sort of finish off the talk. So hopefully this will help in the study. So again, I ask you to engage your imaginations. And we take six lengths of rope. And we tie each bit of rope to a different animal, as you do, you know. So we'll get a snake, a crocodile, a dog, a hyena and a monkey. I don't know how they come up in these suitors, actually. So each of these animals is fastened with a rope. And then we tie all the ropes together in the middle with a big knot. I don't know how you tie six things. I'm sure there's a way of doing it. And so each animal is pulling in a different direction. And each animal is going to where it wants to go. So the snake, for example, tries to go to the anthill. The crocodile wants to go to the water. The bird wants to fly up into the air. The dog wanders into the village to find humans. The hyena will go to the sort of the carnal ground where all the dead animals are for feasting. And the monkey wants to climb up on trees into the forest. And this is exactly what's being suggested in this sutta that we're going to be studying. It's from the Samyutta Nikaya, if you're interested. And the discourse on the simile of the six animals. But of course it's a metaphor. It's to show the state of our senses and how our senses are. All six of them, according to Buddhism, of course. So there's the mind sense. There's eye, ear, nose, tongue and body, of course. And they're each drawing in their own preferred direction, all in the pursuit of pleasure, to avoid suffering and away from pain, yeah? So the Buddha describes this as a situation with our own undisciplined state, and thus we can find no freedom, as each of our senses will pull us in one direction after another, eventually exhausting us, and will become a mixture of desire and evasion. Does that sound familiar? So what do we do? How do we solve this problem? How can we find freedom? So the Buddha offers us the solution. So for those engineers amongst you or those thing, the solution is we take a stake and we drive it through that central knot to hold down each of the animals at a single point. And this is the stake of mindfulness. And it's through mindfulness that we can find the freedom. And of course, it sounds like a paradox. How can staking ourselves down be the route to freedom? Surely freedom comes from doing whatever we want and whenever we want. What could we do with all the time, money and good looks in the world? Go wherever we want, whatever draws us our fancy. Surely this is the freedom we seek. Surely that will bring permanent happiness. So we need to look more deeply at the Buddha's solutions. His communication to us in our unenlightened state from his enlightened state. The man who found complete freedom and ultimate liberation from bondage. So let's look at each of the animals, our senses. Each animal thinks it's free, or our senses are free, in itself, to wander down the avenue of its likes and dislikes, pursuing pleasure, avoiding pain, going where it believes will bring it pleasure, from the places it likes. But this is, of course, is bound to affect the other senses. So in order to go to that place, it will need to pull along all the other senses. So whatever is the strongest will probably win. I think in this case, probably the crocodile. What we do with each of our senses will affect the other senses. Thus, acting from compulsion will only cause suffering from the other. So the addict may not mentally want the drugs, but the body's suffering withdrawal symptoms. Our mind perhaps likes the effects of a bit of alcohol, but then the body feels the effects of the poison the next morning with a cracking hangover. And I'm sure you can come up with your own examples. So what the Buddha is saying is that mindfulness offers us the necessary restraint to overcome this tug of war that's going on between our senses. We notice how one of the senses draws us in a particular direction. So when the mind wanders off in pleasurable thoughts, or the body feels a sense of desire and wants to pursue this or that, we catch these impulses with mindfulness and gently, but firmly, bring ourselves back to that central position, the here and now. So becoming fully present with what is and finding contentment in that, rather than rushing off for stimulation outside ourselves, we can find peace in our current field of experience. And as the mind settles and the senses settle down, the mind becomes more powerful, more controlled and more at peace. The sutta ends in a rather lovely way, with each of the six animals lying down next to each other quite contentedly, no longer needing to exert themselves and no longer needing something else. The tug of desire and aversion has been quieted. Restlessness and anxiety has subsided, doubt and indecision put to rest. The mind then is open to experience, to what is, and is open and can thus find freedom. It is this mind we are seeking, the unlimited mind, capable of experiencing freedom through wisdom, Not freedom to shallowly seek our sense desires, here and there, with no regard to the consequences, where we like. It's the ability to shake off all constraints of desire completely and investigate experience as it is. So it's not what we see, hear, feel or taste or touch or think that's the important thing, but it's how we respond to what we see, hear, taste, touch or think. Yeah. So it's not what we see, but it's how we respond to it. So our view that finding freedom is having all that we desire, then all our wishes will be satisfied. Whatever we desire, then we'll be satisfied. But the Buddha takes that false view and completely turns it on its head. And he says that if we really truly want to find freedom, we need to be free from the wanting itself, free from desire, free from craving. Yeah. We consider the stake of mindfulness to be the fetter and freedom to be the ability to get the object what we want, whereas the Buddha actually says the pursuit of happiness is to be the fetter. That's what's holding us back. And mindfulness is the way to be free. So this is liberating and revolutionary, as it was, as it is now, as it was, you know, over 2,500 years ago. And, you know, it's perfectly exemplified in our consumer culture, suggesting we need to fulfill our every desire and then you'll be happy, then you'll find freedom. So this radical transformation or turning about of consciousness comes from realising, from fully integrating this, knowing that finding freedom is within us and not from outside of ourselves. And mindfulness is the key. And it's no coincidence that this was the Buddha's last words before his final parinirvana. And that's what I'm going to finish on to, for finding no better words or no better ending. So with mindfulness, strive on.